This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The nature of evil has long fascinated historians and storytellers, and most of us have wondered at one time or another what it would be like to come face to face with someone capable of inhuman cruelty. Our guest, Italian journalist Riccardo Arizio, has spent years tracking down former dictators, living either in exile or in captivity in their own countries. His new book, Talk of the Devil, is based on his interviews with deposed rulers from seven countries and their relatives. His subjects include Idi Amin of Uganda, Jean-Claude Duvalier of Haiti, and Mira Markovitch, the wife of Slobodan Milosevic. The dictator's crimes range from torture to mass execution to, in two cases, cannibalism. Some of them amassed enormous personal wealth at the expense of their poor nations. Others seemed driven by ideology. Riccardo Arizio has lived in Milan, London, and Atlanta, and has served as foreign correspondent for CNN and two Italian newspapers. He now lives in Kenya with his wife. Riccardo Arizio recorded this Fresh Air interview with Dave Davies last week while I was away. Dave has guest-hosted Fresh Air and is a senior writer and reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News.
Craving attention, anxious to talk to you, dying to be important again?
No, quite the opposite. Maybe dying to be important, certainly, but certainly not interested in having a conversation with me or with any journalist. They all feel that they have nothing to gain from giving another interview or talking to people who associate their name with evil. They say, whatever I'm going to tell you, you are not going to change your opinion about me, so why should I talk to you? In many cases, the chase, trying to locate these people, trying to have access to these people, have been more difficult and more, in a way, more fascinating and certainly much longer than the actual encounter, the actual conversation with these people.
Idi Amin, you found living in Saudi Arabia, in the city of Jeddah, living the life, he says, of a devout Muslim.
Oh, yes. He lives this very secluded life in Jeddah, in Saudi Arabia. He's the host. He's the guest of the Saudi royal family, and he's someone who has no regrets at all.
But he is probably the most notorious dictator in Africa. Is it true that he actually practiced cannibalism?
Well, he claimed to be a cannibal. He said in a famous interview, said, "Oh yes, you remember that minister of foreign affairs that used to sit in my government some time ago? Well, you know, I got him killed, and actually I ate his flesh." And he made the joke, I didn't like him when he was alive. I actually didn't like him when he was dead because his flesh was too salty for me. Now, it's very difficult to understand whether there was a highly ironic statement to make to go along with the cliche that we all have in the West about cannibalistic African dictators, or whether he's just was and still is plainly mad.
He was known for broadcasting executions on television, right?
Yes, and making sure that the people who were going to be executed were wearing white shirts in order to make the blood more visible to television viewers. He became quite famous when he used to send shiploads of Ugandan bananas to Great Britain, saying, "I hear that you have some economic troubles. Please feed yourself with these good bananas. Remember that, you know, we have a lot of history in common. We used to be your colony. We're still good friends." Now, you know, was it being very satirical? Was it being very ironic towards, the British government? Or, again, it was plainly mad. He used to name one of the streets of Kampala after Adolf Hitler, and he used to send telegrams to Richard Nixon in the White House saying, "I hear you have a problem with the Watergate. Just kill your opponents." It's a bit ruthless, you know, but it works quite well. It's a very efficient way to deal with internal opposition.
The advice was to have them all killed?
Yeah.
When you finally reached him, I mean, of all the people, he probably had the reputation for being the most sadistic. Did it seem that you were in the presence of a man who was frightening, unhinged?
Yes, he's an extremely friendly man, quite jovial in his mannerism. At the same time, he acts and looks like someone who could kill you. just for no reason.
What gave you that feeling about him?
Well, for instance, he looked at me and said, you know, I'm still on top of things. I'm still a good friend with a lot of important people. Do you believe me? Of course. You have to believe me because this is what I'm telling you. And I said, yes, of course, Mr. President. But I'm sure that maybe not on that occasion, but on similar situations 20 years before, he could have killed somebody who was saying, oh, no, no, this is not like you say. You know, he doesn't have any moral value and he's totally detached from reality. Besides, he's killed 300,000 people at least and caused so much suffering that, you know, what makes it, you know, another victim doesn't make any much difference.
And he's still interested in African affairs and apparently trying to intervene. Didn't he ask you to try and get a package to northern Uganda?
Yes, he tried to send containers full of sensitive equipment to northern Uganda, southern Sudan, where his eldest son is staging a war against the Ugandan forces, possibly on behalf of the Sudanese Islamic government. So he's still somehow involved. And, you know, if you try to analyze the reasons why the Saudi royal family is giving him safe harbor, they must have a political reason for doing that, apart from the reason, the official reason, which is Islamic solidarity that is due to a former head of state. So somehow Idi Amin is still involved in African politics and especially in that terrible war that is destroying that part of Africa where eastern Congo, northern Uganda, southern Sudan meet.
We're speaking with Ricardo Arezzo. He is the author of a new book, Talk of the Devil, in which he interviews seven tyrants, and in some cases the relative of these former dictators from other parts of the world. Ricardo Arezzo, Jean Bedel Bokassa of the Central African Republic is not as well known as some of the other leaders that you interviewed, but among the more bizarre, he considered himself above other heads of state because he crowned himself emperor in 1977. What was that coronation like?
Oh, yes. It was one of the most bizarre episodes of recent African history. He spent one-third of the national budget on that farcical coronation ceremony. He had thousands of bottles of French champagne imported to Central Africa. He had a golden carriage pulled by white horses. And he spent an enormous amount of money in having a crown crafted by Parisian jewelers that reminded of the Napoleonic crown. Actually, he believed to be a Napoleon, and the event was staged in the Bokassa Stadium on Bokassa Avenue near Bokassa University. And he invited all the most powerful men on earth. And none of them actually accepted the invitation. Only minor figures attended the coronation ceremony. But in a way, when I interviewed him, when I said why you did that, he said, well, first of all, I was not paying that money because France gave me the money to afford the ceremony. So if they paid, why should I have refused? And second, he said, only because I'm African, you believe I cannot be a little bit grandiose about myself? Why African heads of state could not, you know, should not have the same paraphernalia that, you know, Western heads of state had. I said, but, you know, Western heads of state do not proclaim themselves emperors. But he said, you know, my father was a king, and therefore I was entitled to have a proper crown and to sit on a throne that was of imperial proportions.
Bokassa spent a lot of time enriching himself in this poor country, but he was also known for a lot of brutality. Right?
Yes, of course. The French paratroopers who eventually deposed him found corpses, human corpses, in the fridges of the imperial palaces.
And in the refrigerators?
Yes.
Next to the kitchens?
Yes, yes. Now, whether that necessarily means that he was also a cannibal, as it is claimed by several sources, this is not sure. I asked him the question. He said, no, of course, I've never been a cannibal. How can you think that a French army officer, as I was before, becoming the president and then the emperor of Central Africa, could also be a cannibal. I fought for the French against the Nazi Germans during the Second World War. I was trained in Western military academies. In a way, he was trying to say, I'm a civilized person. How can you believe that I was a cannibal? But on the other hand, you know, it is well known that the elders of the African tribe where he came from were and still are cannibals. So the story is not entirely far from reality.
Did he have any explanation for keeping cadavers on ice at the kitchen where one of his residents is aware?
No, he didn't have any explanation. He just said, these are all inventions. This is no reality. The French tried to damage my reputation, inventing all these stories. But they only had the political agenda to pursue. I was not useful anymore to the French government, and so they tried to destroy me and to depose me.
Unlike other leaders who you interviewed in exile, when you interviewed Bokassa in 1994, he was living in the country that he exploited.
Right? Yes, he had been sentenced to life. Then the sentence had been commuted and a shorter one. But yes, he was a free man. But I must say he was a free man with no financial means. And he was a very sad Sikh old man. But, you know, the idea that you can put a head of state or a former head of state in front of a tribunal and put it on trial is a very recent idea. It's a very young idea that is still not accepted by everybody, as we know. And, you know, in those days, it was totally inconceivable that a former leader, world leader, as he was, as he had been, could face that kind of justice.
You found the former dictator of Haiti, Jean-Claude Duvalier, in France. He was, of course, the son of his father, known as Papa Doc, François Duvalier. He appears to be a tyrant who took to his role somewhat reluctantly. He says he was only 19. He wasn't so sure he wanted to do it.
Yes, he actually said, I want to go to university. I don't really want to become a political leader. I don't want to be involved in the family business, which was ruling in a ruthless way Haiti. But he told me this amazing story. He was 19. He was called to his father's office. All the father's assistants and counselors were around him. And Papa Doc told him, son, you don't know, but I'm going to die soon because I'm seriously ill. And the revolution duvalieriste, our revolution has to go on. And being you the only man in the family, you have to take on the job. He said, but I'm too young. Father said, remember the books that I gave you to read about Roman emperors or about De Gaulle, about important historical figures? You should have read the books and now you should be ready to take on the job as president of life. And Baby Doc said, well, but the constitution says that you cannot be head of state until the age of 30. And father said, oh, don't worry about that. We'll change the constitution tomorrow. In fact, next days, the constitution was changed. The age was brought down to 20, but Papa Doc died when Baby Doc was still 19, but nobody noticed, of course. A few days later, Baby Doc Duvalier became president for life of Haiti.
One of the things that is most known about this period of Haiti was the brutality of the Tonton Macoute, the secret police. And when Jean-Claude Duvalier ascended, as you said, to the leadership of the country, really as a teenager, I wonder to what extent he was aware of their brutality and to what extent he ever thought of striking a different course. Could he even be his own man?
No, he could not. You know why? Because the father, even when he was dead, he was still the most powerful man in the country and the most powerful person within the Duvalier family. Papa Doc Duvalier is still a god in the, you know, voodoo firmament. And actually, Baby Doc Duvalier never felt to have the freedom to change the situation because there was somebody above him, his father, still looking down and making sure that things were run, you know, according to the family rules. You know, he takes voodoo religion very, very seriously. And he says, you know, you Westerners criticize us for this voodoo rituals and voodoo customs, but this is our religion. We don't criticize you for your religion. Why should you criticize us for our religion? That's part of our culture. That's part of our heritage. And the Tonton Macoute, let's remember, were not only henchmen. They were also agents of the voodoo sects within the African black population of Haiti. The population was subjugated not only to the ideology of Duvalierisme, was subjugated by the religion. Religion had been an instrument. And you ask me, was Baby Doc aware? Of course he was. He's still hoping to become a semi-god in the voodoo firmament once he's dead. It's part of his life and hopes for the future.
Did you speak to people in the New York City, for example, who hoped to bring him back to power?
Absolutely.
What were your impressions of
them? There are regular meetings, and they worship the good old days of Duvalier, because they say at least in those days there were jobs, there was no hunger, there were roads. And go to Haiti today and look what happened in the meanwhile with your democracy, with your freedom, with your empty slogans that you try to impose. We didn't need that. We had our own regime based on our traditional values, and yes, maybe it was a bit tough on the opposition, but you know, it was a price worth paying in order to have all the other things that in the meanwhile have disappeared.
The Duvaliers were known for enriching themselves, owning major enterprises which got cash breaks from the government, and yet Jean-Claude lives a relatively austere life now. Where did all his money go?
The first wife managed to secure a very important settlement during the divorce case. Besides, Duvalier loved to spend the money he had. So he lived a few very flamboyant years after his exile, after being deposed. And then the rest of the money was taken by the wife. So he lived through some difficult years. The current wife, who's not wealthy at all, she used to pay the electricity bills for him, the water bills, the restaurants for him. He didn't have a single penny. So I asked him, how do you live now? And he says, you know, some friends help me. Possibly the friends who still hope in a future Duvalier regime. Because a lot of people in Haiti, a lot of people who now live in Europe and in the States, made huge financial profits out of the Duvalier family. It's not only Duvalier and his immediate family that profited from that.
You spoke with Mira Markovic, the wife of Slobodan Milosevic. You spoke to her while her husband was in The Hague on trial for war crimes. Interesting, in the interview, there was a moment when she actually phoned him and didn't ask you to leave the room. What did you observe of their interaction?
Well, they were chatting like teenagers and giggling like teenagers. And at the end of the conversation, she said, oh, Slobodan is such a beautiful man. I really adore him. No political statement. She didn't say, oh, he's so intelligent, or he's so, you know, a great politician, a great leader, great statesman. She said, oh, he's so beautiful. Huh. And, you know, I know that she made several similar remarks in other conversations, and you wonder of the sanity of somebody who can encapsulate the biography of Slobodan Milosevic saying he's a beautiful man. What about the ethnic cleansing? What about the suffering? What about the disaster of 10 years of wars in the former Yugoslavia?
Well, you asked her and other leaders involved in the ethnic cleansing about that. What did they tell you?
Well, she told me two different things. The first one is that it is not true, that these are fantasies, these are propaganda. The second is that maybe some excesses were committed on the ground, but it was not the leadership's fault. It was not because somebody in Belgrade had decided so, but because some little obscure fanatical men on the ground had gone a little bit too far, maybe. But she said, this is not my fault. Go and ask them why they did it.
It's the opposite of I was following orders. People were not following orders.
Yeah, but then I went and talked to the little obscure man on the ground, including a couple of people who are now sitting in The Hague, waiting justice, just like Mr. Milosevic. And they said, "But we were a little man. We were not aware of these political plans. We had been brainwashed. We had been told that it was a matter of a life or death, and that we had to defend the Serbian people against its many, many enemies." And yes, we were a little bit, we were brainwashed by Mira Markovic and her husband. It is their fault. They should have known better.
Few Americans know much about Albania, which was ruled for nearly a half century by Enver Hoxha and his wife, Nesminge Hoxha. Enver Hoxha died in the 1980s. You found his wife now living in a prison cell in the capital of Tirana. When you went in, you went with a female host who actually found it, was afraid to look at her. What was that all about?
Yes, she was afraid to look at her. She was even afraid to pronounce Mrs. Hoxha's name, because that name was inspiration of terror and horror for many generations of Albanians. She was afraid to look at this woman in the eyes, maybe because she had been brainwashed that this super powerful couple, Mr. and Mrs. Hoxha, Uncle Enver, as he was called, and the wife, had incredible supernatural powers. You know, we have to remember that the streets of Tirana, the capital city of Albania, the streets of Albania were full of slogans saying, "Thank you, Uncle Enver, for the incredible progress and wealth of Albania. Thank you for giving us this fantastic life. Thank you, Uncle Enver." And Albania was, still is, one of the poorest countries in the world, was one of the most isolated countries in the world. It was a big, huge bunker. And actually, to show how isolated the country was, she and her husband had built 700,000 small bunkers with holes to keep guns pointed towards, you know, some enemies that, according to them, were ready to invade Albania. And you know why the enemies wanted to invade Albania, according to the ideologists of the Albanian regime? Because Albania was the last remaining bastion of pure socialism. They had dismantled their relationship with the Soviet Union in the 60s because they said, you know, after Stalin, Soviet Union has betrayed real socialism. Then they became allied of the Chinese. But then in the late 70s, early 80s, China's went soft. They said, betrayed again the ideology. So, you know, they said, we are like the stalwarts of the purity of the ideology.
The Hoxhas also carried Marxist orthodoxy to real extremes, for example, in persecution of religion.
Absolutely. They destroyed every single church and mosque in the country, and they were the first country that proclaimed itself and the official religion being atheism. And again, when I made this point to Mrs. Hoxha, who was in a prison cell, I said, but how is it possible? I mean, it's not civilized to destroy every single place of cult in the country. She said, there might have been excesses committed in this area. I agree. But let's not forget that religion can also be very poisonous and very dangerous. See what's happening now in the Balkans. See what's happening in many countries where religion is taken as an excuse for terrorism, for fundamentalist opinions. So she said, you know, in a way, we were living in a day where there was a division in the world between East and West. We belonged to the East, or rather we were even better than the Eastern Bloc. And in those days, it was important to state that religion doesn't differentiate between citizens of the same country. Albania has Christian Orthodox, has Catholics, has Muslims, and under ours, there were no troubles between the three different communities. And nowadays, there are troubles.
She seems to be a contrast to some of the dictators you interviewed in that the couple did not seem to enrich themselves at their country's expense the way some other rulers did. What were they motivated by?
I think they were motivated by a very Sikh form of idealism, if you want. They were motivated by their experience as partisans in the civil war against the Nazi Germans and against the fascists during the Second World War. They, in a way, believed that Albania should not change from the Albania of 1946, after the Italian occupation, after the German Nazi occupation, this new Albania opening to the world. They believed that in 1986 Albania should be the same as it was 40 years earlier. So they were not motivated by financial ambitions. There were rumors of the Hoxha family having, you know, bank accounts in Switzerland, owning property in several countries, Italy, South Africa. And that was not true. I'm not saying this in their excuse. I'm not saying that this justifies the crimes committed by them. But I'm saying that, yes, their case was a very evident case of somebody who did what they did, pursuing an extremist political agenda, and not necessarily personal agenda, even if it's interesting to remember that Mr. and Mrs. Hoxha and their sons were the only people in Albania allowed to own and drive a private car for 40 years. No one else in Albania had or was allowed to have a car.
Ricardo Arizio, it's remarkable that you spent years tracking down these dictators and their relatives, all of them accused by human rights organizations of a whole list of atrocities. And in the 200 pages of interviews, nobody admits to doing anything wrong. They're all victims of circumstance, prisoners of a difficult historical juncture, slandered by their enemies. Were you surprised that no one accepted responsibility?
Yes, I was, because I was hoping to find people who are getting older, who really have to face maybe the last years of their life, people who have to reconcile themselves with themselves. And I was hoping to find somebody ready to maybe cry in front of me and say, yes, I was horribly wrong. I was horribly wrong, and I want to ask forgiveness for that. It didn't happen. They all went into the minutiae of the little things that justified this act or that other act. They didn't see, in a way, the bigger picture, which was the bigger picture of the horrible suffering caused by their actions. And it is, in a way, very discomforting to see how little we remember about these people. These people were the men and the women behind the killing fields. These are recent historical events, and still we are all too ready to forget or maybe even to forgive them.
It is one of the most striking things, I think, about the book, because I think when we look at the world's most brutal leaders, we expect to be fascinated. We expect to see people who are monsters, perhaps tormented by some psychological damage, but they seem ordinary, uninteresting people.
Yes, but some psychopaths are really ordinary people, look like or behave like ordinary people. And this is, I think, has to be a warning. I mean, when a democracy, when a society is in danger, it is not necessarily because a very remarkable person is trying to take over. It might be somebody who initially looks like a normal politician, might be somebody who initially looks like a normal general. But eventually this person, and also the historical circumstances, cause a tragic situation. We should be very vigilant in a way and see and recognize the early symptoms of a dictatorship.
Did you, when you talk to these people, find any of them that you think might have succeeded in a Western democracy, who had leadership skills that might have worked in a different context?
Well, certainly Milosevic is someone who had certain skills that could have been applied to a Western democracy. He is a man I'm sure many Western leaders thought that you can do business with. It is not a coincidence that he was welcomed and invited to the United States when he was negotiating and then signing the Dayton peace agreement for the Balkans. In fact, his wife says, you know, so if my husband is such a monster, why nobody said he was a monster while he was at Dayton putting an end to the wars in the Balkans and signing the Dayton Agreement. You know, in a way, it was a moment of statesmanship for him.
Did you find anything in common in the family histories of these dictators, particularly in their relationships with their parents? Anything strike you?
Yes. In a way, they were all looking for a father figure. They were all looking for somebody bigger, more important. They were all looking to be adopted. Mengistu wanted to be adopted by Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet leader of the time, and he called him my father. Bokassa wanted to be adopted by General de Gaulle, the French president. And Idi Amin, of course, wanted to be accepted at Buckingham Palace as a peer. And Jaruzelski was infatuated with Mikhail Gorbachev and with the previous Soviet leaders. And it's very interesting to see how many of them actually lacked a real father. They didn't have a father, or they lost their father very early in their life, or they had a very difficult relationship with their father. In a way, they were all looking for a new big daddy, as Idi Amin used to call himself.
I wonder if any of the former dictators you spoke to were troubled by the experience of the former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, who strayed from his country, found himself arrested and held accountable for his crimes.
Quite the opposite. The few ones who mentioned Pinochet did so, saying, Pinochet is still wealthy, still respected by some sections of the Chilean society. He's still free after that episode in Britain. And, in a way, yes, of course, many people think that Pinochet was a terrible dictator, but he's not labeled a monster. So why you want me to bear the label of a monster? And, in a way, yes, they used the story of Pinochet as another explanation of why we're using double standards towards them.
Ricardo Rizzio, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ricardo Orizio is the author of Talk of the Devil, Encounters with Seven Dictators. He spoke with Dave Davies. Dave has guest-hosted Fresh Air and is a senior writer and reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News. Their interview was recorded last week while I was away.